the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Greig.
Drop what you're doing!
Illustration of the blessing of living in Lee Greenwood's America. America in this instance, of course, spelled with a K. This is from, I believe, the Chicago Sun-Times. The headline is pretty self-explanatory. Drug cops smash into wrong house, terrorize elderly couple. That's a very commonplace occurrence. We're always told that these are isolated incidents, and I must acknowledge the yeoman work which has been done by Radley Balko of Reason Magazine in documenting and tracking just how commonplace these isolated incidents really are. Now, here's the meat of the story. I'm going to butcher the names involved in this account, and I give my preemptive apologies for that offense. Andrzej and Anna Jakimek, I'm going to say Jakimek, were startled by a late-night raid on their home by Cook County Sheriff's Police Gang Crimes Narcotics Unit officers executing a search warrant. Cook County Sheriff's Police on a drug raid smashed into a southwest side house late Thursday night, terrorizing the elderly couple who lives there before admitting that they had the wrong house. Now, let me stop here just a second and make a crucial observation, which most people don't take into account when they read stories of this sort. Increasingly commonplace, but reliably infuriating stories of this sort. Late night raid. This is exactly the same kind of thing as the proverbial 3 a.m. knock or 6 a.m. knock. Whenever they conduct these raids, they always do it either late at night or early in the morning, under cover of darkness. And that's purely for psychological purposes. Well, not purely. I suppose the purity of the psychological tactic is somewhat cut by the officer safety imperative, which, of course, is the highest and holiest priority of our government's punitive priesthood. To continue. Quote, Sheriff's police this morning said they targeted the home and obtained a search warrant based on information from an informant who had provided credible information in the past. Okay, you have an informant, you have police conducting a late-night raid. Now, put those two elements into the mix. What country does this sound like? Or what recently deceased political entity had law enforcement officers who behaved in roughly the same fashion? As soon as we entered the home, we knew this couple was not involved in the activity alleged, Sheriff's Police Spokesman Steve Patterson said in an email. Our officers immediately requested the assistance of an interpreter and, as a precautionary measure, a medic, who, while also asking the couple to contact a relative who could assist in the situation. Patterson said the department has reached out to the family. The search warrant for the home in the 5600 block of South Kilbourne Avenue cited suspected crystal meth, cocaine, guns, and money. It also named a 23-year-old suspect whom the Jakimeks say they have never heard of. With her husband already asleep, 84-year-old Anna Jakimek was just turning out the lights when she heard loud noises at the back and front doors about 11:30 p.m. Her initial thought was that her 89-year-old husband had fallen out of bed. 89 years old, 89 and 84. But she realized something else was happening when she looked out into the front room. I see maybe 20 guys come in and see the door knocked open. These people are searching for drugs. They're not looking for a dirty bomb. They're not looking for chemical weapons. They're not dealing with the hostage situation. They're looking for chemicals. That's what results in a late-night full-force raid. A no-knock search warrant is issued on the basis of the unsupported allegation of a crook. They show me a sheet with a woman and a man who complained, "We have that. We don't," Anna Jakimek said. "They broke two doors and a garage window. They say, come on, come on, go, 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 stay by your husband." He said someone complained that we had all these drugs. Okay, that's her account. Remember what the police department spokesman said? Our officers immediately, as soon as we entered the home, we knew this couple was not involved in the activity alleged. You're lying, sir. You treated them as suspects. You terrorized this couple in the ninth decade of their lives. Son Andrew said the most potent drug in the home is aspirin. They don't smoke, drink, or even watch TV. They believe in America, he said. Well, they used to. He added that his father, Andrzej, suffers from Alzheimer's disease and has terminal cancer. He won't even take pain medicine. Okay, here's the kicker. The former Ukrainian residents have lived in the house since 1967, according to their son. He said his father is a retired tailor and his mother worked as an elevator operator into her late 70s for People's Gas Company. His mother, he said, called him after the raid at the request of the supervising sergeant on the scene. When he got there, he said he was told the officers had raided the wrong home. When I arrived, the officer explained they had misinformation but said his job was over and he was leaving. They left a copy of the warrant, but he absolved himself of any responsibility for the raid or the damage, Andrew Kemick said. He estimated the damage to broken doors, locks, and windows at up to $3,000. Everything was violently open. Cabinets were ripped open. Clothes and sheets were everywhere. And pieces of wood where the doors were rammed were all over the place, he said. My parents are refugees from the Soviet Union. They are naturalized citizens. They have relatives there who were abused for political reasons. You might expect it there, but not here, Jakemic said. Hey, Andy, welcome to the Union of Soviet Socialist American Republics, USSA. That's how things are done today. That's how these guys roll. They are indistinguishable from the people who used to conduct late-night raids in the former Soviet Union. We're dealing with chimeras. A chimera, of course, is a fanciful beast, often composed of equal parts of human and animal genetic material. We're talking about Orwellian pigmen. That's how the pigmen operated in the Soviet Union, and that's how the pigmen operate here. The warrant said police were looking for a 23-year-old man described as Hispanic who lived in the ranch home. Records show a judge last month ruled the man forfeited bond in a drug possession case. The address listed for the man in court records did not match that of the Jakemics. I guess they didn't take the time and trouble to read the warrant and to be sure about the address. I guess only the top-level models among the pigmen in Chicago can actually read. Anna added, I didn't believe it was the police. They broke everything. I told them they should have rung the bell. You know, there was a time when that was standard operating procedure. Knock, 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 police. We have a search warrant. They show you the search warrant, and you let them in. Now, as I mentioned in the last hour, if you ask to see a search warrant, that's considered obstruction. And you're subject to some kind of summary mistreatment. Patterson said the gang's narcotics unit has served more than 500 search warrants over the last 4 years, and it is incredibly rare that those searches have resulted in this sort of outcome. I would be willing to bet that most of the outcomes are worse than this. He said the incident itself is under review, and the sheriff's office is evaluating the original information given to them about the home. He added the sheriff's office is looking into the property damage that took place during the incident. So we're in the opening phase of an investigation that will absolve the police. That's what those investigations do. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Back at you in just a minute.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397 here on the Liberty News Radio Network. Once again, I would recommend that if you're interested in knowing more about my perspective, in any case, on what's going on in New Hampshire with this outrageous case of Cheyenne Irish, the newborn child who was abducted at gunpoint by officials in Concord, New Hampshire, a couple of days ago, please go to Pro Libertate, the blog, at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. This is, of course, a moving target, this story. It is a story in progress, a story in development. There are going to be further details come out, no doubt, regarding the domestic violence, child abuse allegations that are the supposed rationale for separating that youngster, that newborn infant, from her mother, practically on the moment of her birth. She was less than half, no, she's about a half a day old when this happened. All that being said, this must be kept in mind. 2 points. The first of which is that if there are concerns about the mother being a victim of domestic violence and the father being an abuser, you don't kidnap the child. If the father is accused of serious crimes, if you can make a case to justify arresting him and indicting him, charging him with a crime, you take him into custody. You don't take the child away from the mother at gunpoint. The other important point to keep in mind is that one of the seven criteria listed, one of the seven categories, I should say, because there were multiple criteria, they didn't have one compelling reason to do this. And anytime somebody engages in the old card stacking fallacy, trying to build up a big pile, an impressive volume of complaints or problems or grievances, generally speaking, if you don't have one or two really compelling grievances, what you do try to do is overwhelm somebody with piddling and really trivial or inconsequential complaints. They have seven categories, multiple grievances, but the one that we have to focus on is the fact that among the stigmata of unsuitability here, supposedly, was the fact that Jonathan Irish had some distant, tenuous connection to the Oath Keepers, an organization which was misrepresented in that document as a militia. It is not a militia. As a matter of fact, most of the people attached to the Oath Keepers are considered to be a finer cut of humanity than the rest of us because they wear government-issued costumes and they carry guns. Aren't those the best people? Aren't those the really important people? We see these individuals are suspect because, unlike too many others who follow that profession, people who are attached to the Oath Keepers take the Constitution seriously, and the oath that they take to the Constitution is how they define their jobs. And they have solemnly promised not to carry out patently unconstitutional orders. That's what makes them troublesome. And the fact that Jonathan Irish had some connection with this organization is the central point in this entire controversy. It was brought up in spite of what solemn assurances we're hearing now from the child snatcher bureaucracy in New Hampshire that you cannot seize a child on the basis of an affiliation on the part of a parent. Well, that's what they did. By listing that as one of the criteria, they made that the issue. Because if this isn't a legitimate criterion, why is it in the affidavit? Just before the break, I was talking about this outrageous case, a very typical case in Chicago, involving a couple of octogenarian expatriates from Ukraine. They are naturalized American citizens. They fled Brezhnev Soviet Union in 1967. I doubt that they ever experienced, at the hands of the Soviet secret police, the type of terror that they experienced just a few days ago at the hands of Chicago's police, who, on the strength of an affidavit filed by an informant, now think about that for a second, an informant, they kicked in this couple's house and terrorized them for an unspecified amount of time, causing thousands of dollars in property damage. The 89-year-old husband suffers from terminal cancer and Alzheimer's disease. The 84-year-old mother worked until she was 70 years old in order to provide some kind of meager retirement for this couple. They don't have anything in their home that's stronger than aspirin. In other words, you have a situation where any informant, a liar for hire, can sic the police on anybody in this country. They no longer knock and present a warrant. They kick your door in and they shove a gun in your face. Now, this could have turned out as badly as the Katherine Johnson case did about 4 years ago. Katherine Johnson was a woman, once again, in her 80s. She lived in a bad section of Atlanta. She was targeted for a narcotics raid by a group, some of whom now are in prison, I'm happy to report, a group of corrupt cops who are part of a multi-regional or multi-jurisdictional counter-narcotics group that call themselves Red Dog. Red Dog is an acronym that stands for Run Every Drug Dealer Out of Georgia. Their purpose was to generate federal subsidies by running up statistically impressive numbers of drug crackdowns, drug arrests, drug operations. An informant pinned Katherine Johnson's address as the location of, I believe it was marijuana deals or marijuana dealing of some sort. Marijuana, of course, like any other controlled substance, should not be controlled. It's not a good thing necessarily. There are appropriate uses of THC. I think that if you're somebody who suffers from chronic pain, if you take THC, and it can be taken not only as an inhalant, it can be taken as a tea. There are other uses you can make of it that have a palliative benefit. That's something that the individual should be permitted to decide for him or herself. The same is true of cocaine, which was used as a topical analgesic back in the 19th century in this country. But the point is that on the basis of an allegation of a marijuana deal taking place at this address, you had these cops invade the home and fire into the home without announcing themselves. This 84-year-old woman who had installed burglar bars on her doors, she was right at the dividing line between a fairly nice section of an Atlanta suburb and the proverbial wrong side of the tracks. She fired back, not knowing who her assailants were, and she was gunned down in her house. And then there was this elaborate fiction concocted by these corrupt officers who went back to their informant and had him retrofit an allegation into the story so as to justify, supposedly, the use of a full-force raid. Well, it turns out the officers who suborned perjury and who murdered Katherine Johnson were eventually sent to prison on official corruption charges. This incident in Chicago could have turned out to be somewhere near that bad. And you have, once again, the common recipe. You have a corrupt inner-city police department. The Chicago counter-narcotics and gang suppression units are probably the most vicious criminal gangs in the entire country. I've written about that. I won't go into the details. They make Vic Mackey and his crew look like Boy Scouts, to be blunt about it. They've been involved in myriad crimes, both petty and severe, often involving not merely physical violence, but on a couple of occasions involving homicides. But you have this inner city narcotics enforcement team that considers itself to be unburdened by constitutional due process, using a report from an informant who is almost certainly a petty criminal himself, trying to get a downward departure from a sentence in exchange for accusing other people of dealing in narcotics. That's how you go about franchising this whole corrupt business. You get people, you get them to implead others. That creates more business. That brings in more federal subsidies. You build up the statistics. With the statistics come revenue. But you have a late-night raid against a home in a suburb of a major city by a corrupt counter-narcotic gang that was sent there by a criminal informant against an elderly couple who had been raised and brought up in the former Soviet Union, where, quite frankly, they were never treated as badly as they were treated just a couple of nights ago in Chicago. That, as I say, is a snapshot of life in Lee Greenwood's America, where at least we know we're free. And, of course, if you think that what we have right now is freedom, you really should be on some kind of mood-altering medication. And most likely, you already are. This is Will Grigg, Pro-Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more sedition after this. Joy of all imaginable joys, the police in New York City are getting a new torture toy. This is from the Gothamist. Tired of NYPD's boring old cumbersome M26 tasers? Check out the hot new X26 model cops are test driving. According to the taser website, the X26 can engage with targets at ranges of up to 35 feet, and it weighs less than half what the M26 weighs, just 7.2 ounces. It also boasts greater incapacitating power, records the time and date of each activation, allows for plug-and-play download via USB connection. Oh, and it sprays confetti every time cops fire it. So it's sort of a festive occasion. Besides making the occasion festive, each colorful piece of confetti doubles as an ID tag to deter misuse by felons. Think about that for a second, to deter misuse by felons. I guess the assumption is that a felon would somehow render a cop inert and then seize the taser from him. I don't know how that would work exactly. 15 of the new tasers are being tested out in 5 precincts, and 4 others will soon be available to officers assigned to the emergency services unit. The Daily News reports 600 of the old M26 models are still in use by the department, but critics say police here and elsewhere have been too quick to use tasers, with sometimes tragic results. In Sydney yesterday, police killed a sexual assault suspect with a taser, and the supposedly non-lethal weapon has led to deaths worldwide. The Raw Story notes a 2008 report from Amnesty International, which found 351 taser-related deaths in the U.S. between 2001 and 2008, a rate of just slightly above 4 deaths per month. And another database of taser-related deaths counts 96 deaths related to the use of tasers since January 2009. Over the weekend, a taser fired at an allegedly knife-wielding man in Inwood failed to work, and cops shot the suspect dead. Could the taser have saved Emmanuel Polino's life? By the way, Emmanuel Polino, I've read the story, is somebody who was in the middle of an argument with his girlfriend, and he was suffering some kind of an emotional breakdown, some kind of an episode, and he actually wanted to commit suicide by cop. He called the police, and when he got the 911 dispatcher on the line, he said something to the effect that he wanted to kill some cops. And so, of course, the cops showed up ready to kill him. And this is one of those instances, ironically enough, where a less than lethal weapon might have worked. This is a situation where lethal force would be justified. This guy came at the officers with a knife, and you don't have to allow yourself to be attacked in order to interdict an aggressive act of violence. Doesn't matter whether you're a police officer or anybody else, if you're not committing an act of aggression but somebody is aggressing against you, you don't have to sit there and allow yourself to be killed. So maybe this is a situation in which a less than lethal weapon might have been a valid choice. Should tasers be used only when a suspect poses an imminent threat, or should police feel free to tase liberally, like when chasing streakers or silencing rabble-rousers? All we know, concludes the Gothamist, is that it's funny when cops taser themselves. By the way, I'm not sure if that's an appropriate use of the word. I don't know if you can turn the word taser, the noun, into a verb. In any case, it's just interesting to see that there is going to be another option for police officers who are inclined to use the taser as an instrument of pain compliance. And that's the rub here. When tasers were first introduced a couple of decades back, the Thomas A. Swift Electromagnetic Rifle is what the acronym originally stood for. And I don't know why they decided to call it that, apart from the fact that the inventor apparently shared my fondness for the Victor Appleton Tom Swift books. That's a nom de plume. It's a pseudonym. Can't remember the name of the guy who wrote the Tom Swift Jr. books. In any case, when these devices were made widely available a couple of decades ago, we were told that this represented a useful innovation in terms of adding another rung to the escalation ladder. You had a nonviolent option here that would give police an option that didn't involve a firearm, which, of course, is a consistently and reliably lethal weapon, in circumstances in which some kind of lethal force will be justified. You're talking about a person who presents a threat of illicit harm to another person. Unfortunately, the taser has become a standard issue instrument of pain compliance, which is a completely illegitimate use of that instrument. It is used consistently against people who pose no threat to anybody but are simply not cooperating. And the other thing that I find quite interesting, of course, is that when a taser is used against a police officer, it is considered to be assault with a deadly weapon. When a taser is used against a non-resisting or non-violent suspect, a mere mundane, and the mundane expires, it's called a taser-related death, but the coroner always goes out of the way in the official report to find some contributing factor, such as heart disease, arteriosclerosis, the most common and popular dodge is to refer to excited delirium as a contributing factor. What is excited delirium? Well, that's a state of mind, a state of hyper-anxiety that apparently leads to some kind of a heart condition that kills a person who just happens to be on the receiving end of a high-voltage electric shock because of the use of a taser. Now, the taser didn't kill the person. That is to say, the police using the taser didn't kill the person. The taser itself is a passive instrument. It has no will. It has no capacity to use itself in a bad way against individuals. So you can't say that the taser killed somebody, but that the taser was used to kill somebody. But that point is moot because, according to the official story, the person wasn't killed by the police using a taser. That person just happened to die while he was being tased by a police officer. Check it out. Anytime you read a story in the government-affiliated media in which there's a taser-related death, there's going to be some passive voice formulation in which it's made clear that the victim of police abuse died of causes unrelated to the taser strike that was going on at the time of expiry. That happens time after time. You know, it's as predictable as a Jay Leno monologue. Here's another very important element of what's going on here. I don't know if I'll have time to finish the story before we go to our next break, but I'll get started on it. Some of you might have seen this already. A California student got a visit from the FBI this week after he found a secret GPS tracking device on his car, and a friend posted photos of it online. The post prompted wide speculation about whether the device was real, whether the young Arab American was being targeted in a terrorism investigation, and what the authorities would do. It took just 48 hours to find out the device was real. The student was being secretly tracked by the FBI, and the FBI wanted their expensive device back. See, the answer came when a half dozen FBI agents and police officers, they sent a half dozen to deal with this poor schlep who just happened to find their little spy device on his car. The answer came when a half dozen FBI agents and police appeared at Yasser Afifi's apartment complex in Santa Clara, California, on Tuesday, demanding he return the device. You know what I'd say? Finders keepers. Well, that's why they sent six of them with guns. Afifi, a 20-year-old U.S.-born citizen, cooperated willingly and said he'd done nothing to merit attention from authorities. Comments the agents made during their visit suggested he'd been under FBI surveillance for 3 to 6 months. An FBI spokesman wouldn't acknowledge that the device belonged to the agency or that agents appeared at Afifi's house. Once again, that is such a salient symptom of totalitarianism. Is this persistent denial of something that is manifestly the fact, the truth, that is politically unsuitable and cannot therefore be admitted. This denial of something that is a public and obvious truth is a persistent trait of totalitarianism. Yeah, we sent a half dozen agents there. Yes, we collected the device. Yes, he was under surveillance, according to what he was told by the agents, but we're not going to admit that for the record. Because we live in a regime where, like in Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union, yesterday's weather can be changed by decree. I can't really tell you much about it because it's still an ongoing investigation, lied spokesliar Pete Lee, who works sick, who is employed in the agency's San Francisco headquarters. Afifi, the son of an Islamic American community leader who died a year ago in Egypt, is one of only a few people known to have found a government tracking device on their vehicle. His discovery comes in the wake of a recent ruling by the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals saying it's legal for law enforcement to secretly place a tracking device on a suspect's car without getting a warrant, even if the car is parked in a private driveway. Anybody happen to remember the name of a judge who was recently appointed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals? J.S. Bybee. J.S. Bybee is the unindicted war criminal who at the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel suborned John Yoo into writing a series of memoranda to say that it was perfectly legal for a president to authorize agents to commit acts of torture that violate U.S. laws, the Constitution, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the Law of Nations. Now he's doing the Fourth Amendment and the other remaining elements of the Bill of Rights, what he did with those laws against torture. This is Will Grave, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in a minute. So this poor kid, 20-year-old kid in Santa Clara, California, discovers a tracking device under his car. A friend says, we ought to take photos of that and post that online and ask if this is really what it appears to be. A few days later, half a dozen FBI agents and local police show up and say, hey, we'll take that back. So the kid hands it back to them, and then the FBI won't acknowledge that anything happened here. Now, that's the sort of behavior you'd expect from people in the employ of a totalitarian government. It's sort of the Sergeant Schultz dodge. I see nothing, nothing. Or Baghdad Bob in the employ of Saddam Hussein's regime saying there are no American troops in Baghdad while they're knocking on the door of whatever palace Baghdad Bob was broadcasting from at that time. The people who act as if they can somehow reconfigure reality to meet the ideological or organizational demands of whatever bureaucracy employs them, that's a human type we could really do without. But unfortunately, a totalitarian bureaucracy produces, as well as attracts, people of that description. It seems very frightening that the FBI have placed a surveillance tracking device on the car of a 20-year-old American citizen who has done nothing wrong, nothing more, rather, than being half Egyptian, said Brian Alseth of the Washington State American Civil Liberties Union. Alfifi, a business marketing major at Mission College in Santa Clara, discovered the device last Sunday when he took his car to a local garage for an oil change. When a mechanic at Ali's Auto Care raised his Ford Lincoln LS on hydraulic lifts, Alfifi saw a wire sticking out of the right rear wheel and exhaust. Garage owner Mazir Khan confirmed for Wired.com that he also saw it. A closer inspection showed it connected to a battery pack and transmitter, which were attached to the car with a magnet. Khan asked Alfifi if he wanted the device removed, and when Alfifi said yes, Khan pulled it easily from the car's chassis. I wouldn't have noticed it if there wasn't a wire sticking out, Alfifi said. Later that day, a friend of Afifi's named Khaled posted pictures of the device at Reddit, asking if anyone knew what it was and if it meant the FBI is after us. My plan was just to put the device on another car or in a lake, Khaled wrote. But when you come home, two stoned off their asses people who are hearing things in the device and convinced it's a bomb, you just got to be sure. A reader quickly identified it as an Orion Guardian ST-820 tracking device made by an electronics company named Cobham, which sells the device only to law enforcement. No one was available at Cobham to answer Wired.com's questions, but a former FBI agent who looked at the pictures confirmed it was a tracking device. The former agent, who asked not to be named, said the device was an older model of tracking equipment that had long ago been replaced by devices that don't require batteries. Batteries die and need to be replaced if surveillance is ongoing, so newer devices are placed in the engine compartment and hardwired to the car's battery so they don't run out of juice. Now think for just a second, I interject, what this means in practical terms. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers the part of the country where I'm living, as well as, of course, California, ruled a couple of months ago that it is perfectly appropriate for law enforcement secretly to place tracking devices on automobiles without warrants. That, of course, is a pile of used food. It is a huge, reeking accumulation of bovine residue, if the Fourth Amendment means anything. That ruling, and I'm going to have to go back and check it, but I suspect that you could probably find that Judge Bybee had a part in that crime against the Constitution, as well as many others. That ruling stated that the police can violate the integrity of your property, can intrude on your private property, and then attach something to a piece of property you own in order to keep surveillance on you without a search warrant, which means they don't need probable cause. They can do this to anybody at any time for any reason. which means derivatively that all of us are, I guess, criminal suspects or potential terrorists. All this, of course, is considered to be perfectly all right. And now we learn that the FBI can lift the hood of your car and attach something to the battery of your car, parasitically draining away electricity so as to keep you under surveillance, even if you're not suspected of anything. In this case, the guy just had the misfortune of being born an Egyptian-American citizen. He's a U.S.-born American citizen whose father just passed away. Let's see here. The former FBI agent said he was certain that agents who installed it would have obtained a 30-day warrant for its use. Afifi considered selling the device on Craigslist before the FBI showed up. He should have sold it. He was in his apartment Tuesday afternoon when a roommate told him two sneaky-looking people were near his car. There they go again. Two sneaky-looking people were near his car. Afifi, already heading out for an appointment, encountered a man and woman looking at his vehicle outside. The man asked Afifi if he knew his registration tag was expired. When Afifi asked if it bothered him, the man just smiled. Afifi got into his car and headed for the parking lot exit when two SUVs pulled up with flashing lights carrying four police officers in bulletproof vests. The agent who initially spoke with Afifi identified himself then as Vincent and told Afifi, "We're here to recover the device you found on your vehicle. It's federal property. It's an expensive piece, and we need to get right now." These guys are wearing bulletproof vests. They're pulling an intimidation tactic. It would have been really cool if Afifi could somehow have said, "No, I don't have it. It's not here. Finders keepers. Tough. Go back to whatever Babbitt Warren you people live in." Afifi asked, are you the guys that put it there?" The agent replied, "Yeah, I put it there." He told Afifi, "We're going to make this much more difficult for you if you don't cooperate." Hey, Vincent, if you're listening to this, you're a thug and a bully. You're a thug and a bully and a coward and a loser. You want my address? You want to find a wrestling mat somewhere? You want to find a ring? Come make it tough for me, you punk. I can't stand bullies. Afifi retrieved the device from his apartment and handed it over, at which point the agents asked a series of questions, which were none of their business. Did he know anyone who traveled to Yemen or was affiliated with overseas training? One of the agents produced a printout of a blog post that Afifi's friend Khaled allegedly wrote a couple of months ago. It had something to do with a mall or a bomb, Afifi said. He hadn't seen it before and doesn't know the details of what it said. He found it hard to believe Khaled meant anything threatening by the post. "He's a smart kid and is not affiliated with anything extreme and never says anything stupid like that," Afifi said. "I've known that guy my whole life." The agents told Afifi that they had other agents outside Khaled's house. If you want us to call them off and not talk to him, we can do that," Afifi said they told him. "That was weird. I didn't really believe anything they were saying." Well, why should you believe anything? They're employed by the government. They're liars. When he later asked Khaled about the post, his friend recalled writing something stupid but said he wasn't involved in any wrongdoing. Khaled declined to discuss the issue with Wired.com. The female agent who handed Afifi a card identified herself as Jennifer Kanan, K-A-N-A-A-N, and said she was Lebanese. She spoke some Arabic to Afifi and through the course of her comments indicated she knew what restaurants he and his girlfriend frequented. She also congratulated him on his new job. Afifi recently got laid off from his job, but on the same day was hired as an international sales manager of laptops and computers for Cal Micro in San Jose. Now this, once again, is redolent of the sort of stuff the KGB used to pull. They used to be able to give you, if you were a dissident in the Soviet Union, a detailed dossier talking about your associations, the books you read, the places you frequented, your domestic situation, and so forth. They used this as an intimidation tactic. "We've been monitoring you and keeping you under our surveillance. We know everything about you. We can make life very difficult for you." Now, why is this, apart, of course, from the general morphology of any political police organization, why is this significant? Back in 1994... on Independence Day, the FBI and the KGB, which of course is now known as the Federal Security Service, or FSB, got married. They got married in a ritual performed at the Lubyanka Square headquarters of the Cheka, which is how that secret police organ was originally styled when it was organized by a squalid, immoral, perverted bank robber by the name of Felix Dzerzhinsky. The director of the FBI, Louis Free, signed a document with a fellow by the name of Sergei Stepashin, which basically put them in business together. You had KGB officers training at Quantico. You had FBI officers running an attaché office in Moscow, and no doubt training at Lubyanka Square. But a year earlier, they had been partners, colleagues, comrades in the assault on the Branch Davidian church slash home at Mount Carmel outside of Waco, Texas. They're in the same racket. They've been doing this sort of thing for a long, long time. And now we see that the family resemblance goes a lot deeper and is a lot more detailed than what you'd expect, given the fact that these people were in the same line of work, whether in Moscow or in Washington. Now they're literally doing the same kinds of things for the same reasons. They're using the same tactics. They're following the same playbook. And when given an opportunity, they'll target just about anybody that they find to be compromisable and try to turn that person into an asset. And that is, I suspect, is what they were doing with this poor, confused Afifi fellow in Santa Clara, California. They bugged his car. They were keeping watch on him everywhere he went. They were harassing him. They were intimidating his friends. And it sounds, once again, very Soviet in nature. Lee Greenwood, check your email. I think I've got some suggestions for your next song about this country. So ends Hour 2 of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and we'd love to hear from you. So stick around.